Good morning, everybody. This is Dave Weiner, and this is a brief, I think, morning coffee notes for Saturday, May 21st, 2005. This morning, I decided to do some work on the outliner, and this is something that I've been like really procrastinating on. And the last time I worked on it, believe it or not, was April 18th, and it's now like over a month ago. I guess a lot of things sort of happen. I got a cold and I went to New York. Every time I take a trip, that like blows up any, like forward motion that I've got in programming. And so I don't know. So I did a warm-up project the other day and got warmed up on programming. And then this morning I got an idea and I said, okay, I'm just gonna like lead myself through this. Whatever blocks I've got here, I'm going to just like get right through it and go start doing some programming. And what I found was that the reason why I was holding back was that I'm really scared about users seeing this software and not liking it and then giving me a lot of crap about it and me not liking that either. And I guess I'm just gonna have to cross that bridge when I come to it, or do enough work on it so that it's not likely to happen. And so that the right people look at it, and when they take a look, they're happy with what they see, and they're productive, and they get work done. And that, that it grows in a way that is manageable. I can see a lot of people being upset about this, and it's really funny because right now, like nobody's upset about it, and think about the math of this. So, you do a bunch of work and you release something, and by the way, it'll be free. You release something for free, and you add software to the world and ideas to the world, and and some people don't like it, and some people do, but the net is you get grief. And I guess that's just the way it is. People could like to complain, and I think the key thing is to not like take that to heart. That to be aware that you've done something. It isn't perfect, but it does net make the world a better place. I think it does. So you may not agree, and that's okay. So, one of the caveats is, well, it uses a feature that's only available on Windows, and therefore the software, at least at first, will only be available on Windows. And that feature is the MDI window, which I think, I don't even remember what it's called, what it stands for. Basically on Windows, the Frontier and Radio, of course, are built out of the same kernel. The kernel of the two programs is identical, and they differ in terms of what the object database contains in the shipping version. Otherwise, there's absolutely no difference between the two. They compile. There are actually, sorry, there are minor. There is a minor difference or two, and those are basically in terms of some flags that are set that allow the program to configure the object database application to configure itself. So it basically, tells you what platform you're running on, whether it's Windows or Mac, what the operating system is. I think it says how much. I don't think it actually does say how much memory there is. And that's a table called system.environment, and that's the difference. Okay, all the differences are encapsulated right there. And I'm using the MDI window is like one big window that encloses all of the windows that the application opens. And it's either seen as a, it's usually seen as a negative. I mean, some people liked it. Bob Bierman, who worked on the port of Frontier from the Mac to Windows in 1997 and 98. He liked the MDI window, or I don't know, or maybe he didn't know how to program it in a way so that you couldn't not like the MDI window. No matter what, we got the MDI window. And for the most part, I would prefer not to have it. But once we had it, I got an idea that actually has turned out to be pretty useful, which is why don't we like project the built-in Windows HTML control onto that window so that basically all of the sub-windows of Frontier appear to be opening up in front of the web. And that really changes the way things look. In other words, you now have a web browser. If you never opened a window, basically, inside of the kernel, then it would be a web browser. And it would be a web browser where you could edit the menus using, and editing the menus probably isn't that big a deal for people. It is for a programmer, though. That the way the editor works in the kernel, the menu editor, it's an outliner and it's like the easiest menu editor. But you know, that wouldn't be a reason to work in the environment. I mean, but what turns out is a worthy reason to work in the environment is that when you think of it as an outliner, then you can open up windows within the web browser that allow you to edit content, which is then both local and over the internet seamlessly. And that turns out to be a big deal because in all my work on content management over the years, the one thing, the constant, I want to say constant fight, but and in a way it's not because it's a creative process, it's not really a fight. It's like the key to good content management, to easy to use content management, is to reduce the distance between the work you're doing on your local computer and the view of that same content to the public on the public web. And that's why blogging was such a big hit. That's why blogging is so easy relative to the previous forms of content management, because it made the distance like zero, basically, because you did all of your work within the context of the browser, and the browser is by definition like on the internet. And so but you gave something up in the process, and the thing you gave up is the high fidelity of an editor that runs on your laptop or your desktop, and you're basically wasting a lot of the capabilities of that local computer. But you gain what you lose in fidelity, in you know, power, you get back in terms of ease of use and a simple conceptual model. That's why you get the ease of use, is because you can have things like an edit this page button, which makes changing content three steps. You click edit this page, you see something wrong on the page, that doesn't count as a step. You know, you get the impulse, I want to fix that because there's a spelling error or I can see a better way to word this. So you look around for the edit this page button, and once you spot it, you click it. It opens up a form. There's the text of the page. You make your change. That's step two. You make your change. You click submit. That's step three. And boom, you're done. It's a three-step process. Edit this page, make the change, hit submit. It doesn't get much easier. Well, it does, actually. You can get it down to one step. And that one step is see the mistake. Actually, let's say two steps, okay? See the mistake. That, of course, never counts as a step because you'll take that. That'll happen no matter what you do, okay? You see the mistake. You bring the window to the front, the window that contains that content. You make the change. Well, here we go. It's three steps. Make the change, and you hit save. But the next change is two steps. Okay? The next step is you make the change and you hit save. You can do that, or get this. You can make five, well, you could do this in the web browser way too. You can make five changes and hit save. But what's cool about this is that you have now gotten into the conceptual model of using a word processor or a spreadsheet, some productivity application that And you know, the funny thing about it is we're now, what, 10 years into the web and 7, 8 years into blogging. And there probably are people in the world now who've started to use computers since then. Well, probably. Of course there are. There are millions of them. There may be more people who've started to use the web since the web, started to use personal computers since the web, since than there were before. In fact, that's a certainty. Now the question is, how many of those people have ever used a word processor? Maybe there are quite a few of them who never have, because what they do is they view the web as the thin client that the computer industry was talking about in 1998, 99, and 2000, the thin client that never materialized, or the thin client that became Windows, or that Windows became, which, by the way, in a slight digression, is why Microsoft's in some deep shit, because Microsoft took their eye off the browser. They said, well, we defeated Netscape, and therefore we don't need to do anything more here. We'll go back to the business as usual prior to the web. We'll pretend the web never happened. We'll just leave the web alone. We'll just keep dominating with IE, and it'll never be a problem again. And it will, because people aren't flocking in droves. I don't know. They probably have a better idea than I do. They have, certainly have much better numbers. All I have is like my intuition. And but the question would be is, how many people of the new people in the last 5 years, new personal computer users, how many of them use word processors? How many of them know that editing can be better than what you get in the browser? Which is, by the way, one of the reasons why I've been like really repeatedly saying, you know, the low-hanging fruit in the browser space for Microsoft and for Firefox and for Safari. I guess those are the three big browsers. Opera is there, of course. And although I think it's getting late for Opera, that in retrospect, the way to win the hearts and minds of users, in my humble opinion, is to invest in editing, to make editing a much better experience. It's kind of like the way when Google, before Google existed, all the portal guys were saying, hey, you know, search doesn't matter. Our users really don't care about search that much. Of course, they were wrong. And, you know, you could say kind of the same thing. Well, you know, editing just isn't really that important. Our users don't care that much about editing. Why would you conclude that? Well, because we have been giving them crap editing and they haven't been complaining about it. Okay? You might conclude it for that reason, right? But think about this. They might not know that it can be better, right? And they may, or they may have a feeling that it can be better, but their techie friends are telling them it can't be better. Or they just never bring it up because they don't think in terms of new features for software. They just sort of accept what's given them because that's just kind of the way the world works, you know? But the opportunity is there nonetheless to make editing much better. So, pop back to where I was before. That is exactly what my piece of software proposes to do. And when you boot it up, it feels more like a browser, I hope, than it feels like an outliner. Or more, and an outliner, of course, is just a text editor with a specific set of assumptions about data. It says the data is organizable, it's structurable. You can edit the structure. It's kind of like text on Rails, which, by the way, I was saying long before Ruby on Rails came around, which is, I don't even really know what Ruby on Rails is, except it's a programming language based on Ruby. And but you know, you can find references, I think, probably references where back to the 80s, where I was explaining outliners as text on Rails, and that, you know, basically, you know, what does it mean to be on Rails? It means that moving things around is easier than it would be that if you had to like a, you know, use a shovel and pail to pick up a pile of sand and move it, you know, 100 miles away. If you had to go 100 miles for each, you know, you didn't have a rail car. Well, you know, if you do have a rail car, you could load up the rail car with sand and then take the whole rail car down on rails down to wherever you need to take it. And if you don't have the rails, you have to move everything once, you know, one pail load at a time, which is what word processors kind of do. And you know, if word processors are lugubrious and slow, then web browsers are horrible. I mean, the problem with web browsers is that making changes is a very frightening process because there are so many ways to lose all of your work. It's totally not error-proof. Nobody ever did a user focus group or, user research or usability testing on editing in a browser, because I know nobody did, because there's just so many ways to make it better with very, very, very little work, And by the way, to the web browser guys, the reason to do this is that, if you it's the old trick. If you can get the programmers to use your platform, the users will follow, because the programmers will make that software work really great on that platform because that's the platform they use. In other words, it's a little bit of a trick. It's a bit of a finesse. But it's a finesse that works, and something to think about. So, the editor that I work on has it has in the Chrome of the browser a very good understanding of the content that it's dealing with. So it knows where its files are, so it presents them to you in a pop-up menu so they're easy to open. It also knows what domains they've been mapped to. And it's very, very easy to say, take this outline and give it a short name like dave.opml.org or george.worldoutline.com or any one of a number of different domains. In fact, you can even point your own domains at it. The back end is also going to be available as something that you can deploy on your server. That's just the beginning, because I want to make a very good, nice little blogging shell for this, so that it's very easy for you to edit a blog in an outliner. And I mean really easy. Easy is going to be the focus of everything in this. It's going to be iterate until it's really, really easy. I may release before it is, but I'm going to really try to get the people to use it to be people who have a sense of software engineering, especially usability engineering, so that we can talk about that. Now, it's going to be hard to get people to get that, okay? There really aren't that many people around that do that kind of work, but it would be wonderful to be able to stage the release so that it comes up on their radar sooner rather than later, which is kind of what I'm hoping to do by starting to talk about this stuff in podcasts, to try to attract those people before doing a release. I seem to be podcasting a lot lately, like almost every day, sometimes 2 times a day. I wonder how many people are able to keep up with it or want to keep up with it, but I am getting some good email from people, and so I get a sense that these podcasts are reaching at least some of the kinds of people that I'm hoping to reach. Maybe 1% of the people who read Scripting News are keeping current on this, and maybe that's okay, because maybe it's the 1% that are sort of really like paying close attention and are really interested. And I also get that some of the old names of people, old people, you're not old people, but if you know what I mean, people that used to comment on my blog in like 98, 99, I'm hearing from them now, and I really like that, because because hey, those were the good old days, right? That was before this stuff was, before everybody was using it, and when you had to be pretty special to sort of find it. And those pretty special people are, pretty special. Sorry. Anyway, I guess we're gonna settle. Let's see, we're 19 minutes. These things get shorter because, we used to do the 40-minute podcast, used to be like the ideal length, and now the 30-minute podcast seems to be what we're doing. And lordy, 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 this one looks like it's gonna be 20 minutes. I want to say one thing. I put up a site. I guess what I want to say is that I've been sort of talking with people at big companies a lot lately, and I said to one of them, I really ought to have my head examined for doing this, because You know, and they're nice people. I think basically nice people. You know, certainly not bad people, you know. But we come from such different worlds, and they're trying to work in the world that I'm really comfortable in, that I've been spending many years not just like grooming the world to be comfortable for me, but also having the rough edges on myself sanded down to the point where, you know, I don't really mind a flame. In fact, it's gone way beyond that. It's gone to the point where I'm trying to engineer the flames. And it's one of the facts of life is that when you enter this space, you're going to be surrounded by flamers. That's just inevitable. And it's not a bad sign because it means that you're connecting. It means that they're not the ones necessarily that you need to connect with, but they're an indicator that there are a lot more people that are listening to you now than were listening to you before. It is kind of a shame in the first few years you're coming to grips with this, you feel really frustrated that these people drown out the other people who don't flame. Because once the flamers show up, you don't hear from the people who don't flame very much. They tend to fade away when the flamers take over. That doesn't mean they're not listening. Okay, that's something I've learned. Because you do hear from them. You know, it's not you don't hear from them the same numbers that you used to before the flamers dominated everything. But you do hear from them, and they are there. I know because I see people at, you know, at private gatherings or conferences or whatever, and I'm surprised to find out that they are very much up to date with what's going on and with me. And I go, well, geez, it's really funny because I just thought you weren't paying attention anymore. And they say, no, I read your site every bit as much as I ever have. And to them, it doesn't seem unnatural to read the site and then not contribute and not participate. It doesn't because the rules change when the flamers take over and it's no longer satisfying for them. And so if it's not satisfying, then they just do the obvious thing. They stop doing it. And that doesn't mean that they stop reading. And so, like, I try to say that the flames aren't something to my, you know, colleagues at the big companies that and the flames aren't something to run away from or to avoid. Because the alternative to the flame is to do everything in private, okay? And when you do everything in private, you tend to only do it with people who you like. And the problem is the world, and then, you know, because there's a difference between who you like and who likes you. It's also because who you like is also a subset of the people who you know, okay? You don't really like people who you don't know, but that doesn't mean, number one, that they can't and won't make a contribution, okay? And it also doesn't mean that their opinion is unimportant. And, you know, it may sound a little flaky, okay? You know, their opinion is important and, you know, well, you know, la-di-da. But the point is that if you don't include them, you're taking a big chance that they'll never support the thing that you want them to support. And that's dead. Death, that's terrible. When you don't have a consensus on a format or a protocol, then you're going to get forked. You're going to get another approach, and it's going to take root. And you're going to have, very likely, not have. Neither one of them will become the juggernaut that would have happened had you been willing to endure a little bit of flaming. In other words, the fact that some people flame should not be a reason not to do it openly. Okay, you should, as soon as you start getting this thought that, well, we ought to bring other people in because it's important to find out what they think, that's the moment when you have to go public with it. Because otherwise, you can play it out, go down the forks in the road, go down each of the branches of the tree, if you want to think of it as a tree instead. None of the other ones work. And we've tried them all. And this isn't 1985 anymore. You know, in 1985, Apple Computer, for example, could have a developer conference, and all of the important developers would come, And we would all sit there and listen, and we would all be thinking while we're listening of a lot of different things. One of the things always we'd be thinking about is how is this screwing me, and how threatened do I feel by this, you know? Because you're hearing about it at a fait accompli, and you're wondering, looking to the left and to the right, which of my competitors already know about this and have already started working on it? And in 86 and 87 and 88, all the way through the 90s, this was like the disaster after disaster that happened. Sometimes you'd be sitting in the room and you were one of the guys who got briefed, so you felt like, okay, I got an edge up here, right? But sometimes you weren't. Sometimes you'd sit in the room and nobody got briefed, like Gersharan Sidhu's presentations about Apple. Talk about a menacing guy. This guy could make you so scared. Or IBM, I remember their presentation of TopView. Again, I think, I don't know, we all felt like we had been herded into cattle cars to be taken away to a concentration camp, you know? Nobody had any inside knowledge of what was going on there, and they talked to us like we were, you know, history, and we had absolutely nothing to do with their future, but we do have to do with their past, and you know, and therefore that's why they're granting us an early look, although it really wasn't very early, you know. And in the end, of course, it didn't matter because because the cursor's never on that approach. It never works. It never. You can feel when you feel that fear, okay, that hey, I got left out of this one. I recommend take a deep breath and think about what I'm about to say. It isn't going to work. Take your deep breath. Let the fear dissipate a little bit because that's what happens when you take a deep breath. All of a sudden, you can feel okay, a little wave of relaxation. Now, let me program you. Okay. It isn't going to work. It isn't going to work. The only way it works is if you take the chance and you get vulnerable and you show your ideas to everybody at the same time. Now you can say, I'm a big company, we don't do things like that. And I can turn around and say, okay, you're a big company and you don't set standards. You're a big company and you're not influential. I can't change the rule of gravity for you. I can't make it. It isn't going to be the way you think it's going to be. It isn't going to be fair the way you think it should be fair. You think the world should wait for you and it should come to a developer conference where everybody, you know, listens to what you want them to do and we all support you. And everybody says, my, these people are smart and you feel very accomplished. But that's a fantasy, and the world doesn't work that way. That just isn't the way the world works. You can have the most successful protocol or format, and the world won't credit you with having done it. It just won't be. That is a fantasy. It's a dream. It's also probably not even worth achieving because, you know, well, it doesn't matter. It ain't gonna happen. I've probably had as much success as anybody has ever had doing this kind of stuff. And believe me, there's no unanimous accolades available. It just simply doesn't happen. Nor, so if you want it to work, you have to, I've got a new term for this called a conversation starter. Not a proposal, not a recommendation, not a suggestion. A conversation starter. And what you hope happens with a conversation starter is, well, first of all, you hope you didn't make any glaring errors. And by calling it a conversation starter, well, people probably still will flame you about your lack of, you know, well, why didn't you check this out with people before you posted it, is what they're going to say. Not realizing, of course, that had you done that, then somebody else would have said, how dare you do this without checking with everybody? Don't you understand how open things work? Well, so you hope that you didn't make any major mistakes when you designed your little thing, right? But if you did, what you want to do is do that breath thing again and just fix it. And right, and you just keep fixing it until you feel that this thing's going to work. All the time you're deploying, all the time, but you're deploying with the caveat that I'm not deploying. Okay? You do test example, you do test cases. You try the ideas out, you put them into practice, and you see if it works. And you do this really quickly with a laser-like focus. Okay? And then before you get overwhelmed with objections and other ways to do it and whatever, you look for what they call in the IETF world, you look for what they call a rough consensus. In other words, can you convince two or three other people that this is a really good way to go? And if you can, you got it, okay? And you go. You don't wait for perfection. I've talked about this earlier in other morning coffee notes, is that you have go with a credo. That's probably not right. But you go with a philosophical principle that I'm always looking for the worst possible name. So that means nobody can argue that that was the stupid name, that you should pick a better name for this thing. Go with the worst one. Of course, it's a little bit of a joke. You're not really going for the worst one, but you're not, certainly not trying to find the best one. And you go quickly. And the only way to go quickly is openly. So that's what I can't like put names on all of these. There are certainly quite a few of these kinds of conversations I'm involved with right now. The Syndicate conference was a really open, good example of this process and work. IDG is a big company, and I will always talk about my presentations on the web before I give them. It's a good thing to do because, first of all, it's going to be public. So might as well be public right from the beginning. Got nothing to lose there. And I throw ideas out there, and I do that, you know, I do throw the ideas out that occur to me. If I find it funny or interesting, I throw them out. I just say, fine, here, this is the idea. What do you think? Okay? And that doesn't mean I do every one of them. I don't. And if there are good reasons not to do them, I don't do them. Okay? But a company like IDG is very uncomfortable with this. Again, I did it in the open. I didn't do it in private. Their concern was, well, you can't do this in the open. And I said, yeah, I always do it in the open. And they said, well, you can't do it with us in the open. I said, I don't care. Who are you? This is about syndication. You're a newcomer here. You don't make the rules. And so I said, you don't know me. And they said, that's true. And although, by the way, they do. The guy who runs this branch of IEDG used to be the publisher of Macworld, and he does know me, and I know him. And I think that he should know from that experience that I'm not a person who takes my integrity lightly. But yet, that's exactly what they thought, or that's at least how they acted. Their actions were basically that, you know, you can't trust them. And yet they trusted a lot of other people, which really, really hurts, actually. Anyway, so that's kind of a mini example of that. You know, I wanted to do it openly. A big company that had never done it that way before, is new to blogging, really uncomfortable with it, fired me because I did that. But the conference was better for it. I'm sure it was better for it. Same thing's going on all the time. So anyway, so let's see, how far have we gotten? No, 33 minutes. So we are and within striking distance of the 30-minute goal, and we're not going all the way to 40. So anyway, morning coffee notes. This is May 21st, 2005, Dave Weiner, and hey, have a great day, have a great weekend, have a great life. Okay, bye.